Finally, try to get some rest and encourage her to do the same. Don't be fooled by the adrenaline rush that will hit you when your partner finally goes into labor. You'll be so excited that you'll feel you can last forever. But you can't. She's got hormones and pain to keep her going. You don't. Phase 2, active labor. One of the symptoms of second phase labor is that your partner may seem to be losing interest in just about everything, including arguing with you about when to call the doctor. After my wife's contractions had been 2 to 3 minutes apart for a few hours, I was encouraging her to call. She refused. As I mentioned earlier, many women just know when it's time to go, so chances are if she tells you it's time, you should grab your car keys. That said, you're going to be in regular contact with your partner's practitioner, and if he or she thinks it's time to come in, that trumps your partner's desires to stay home. One of the biggest hints that your partner is in active labor is whether she can walk and talk through the contractions. If not, she most likely is. If you're still not sure that the second phase has started, here's a pretty typical dialogue scenario that may help you decide. You: honey, these contractions have been going on like this for 3 hours. I think we should head to the hospital. Her: okay. You: great, let's get dressed, okay? Her: I don't want to get dressed. You: but you're only wearing a nightgown. How about at least putting on some shoes and socks? Her: I don't want any shoes and socks. You: but it's cold out there. How about a jacket? Her: I don't want a jacket. Get the point? Another common symptom of second phase labor is an uncharacteristic loss of modesty. A number of nurses, midwives, and doulas have told me that they can always tell what stage of labor a woman is in just by looking at the sheet on the bed when the pregnant woman is in it. If she's in phase 1, she'll be covered up to her neck. In phase 2, the sheet is halfway down. By phase 3, don't worry, we're going to be coming to that next, the sheet's all the way off. Once active labor has started, your partner shouldn't eat anything unless her doctor specifically says that it's okay. She probably won't be allowed to eat anything after getting admitted to the hospital. If she ends up needing any medication or even a cesarean, food in her stomach could complicate matters. Phase 3, transition. Whenever laboring women are portrayed in TV shows, they almost always seem to be snapping at their husbands or boyfriend, yelling things like, "Don't touch me," or "Leave me alone, you're the one who did this to me." I think I'd internalized those stereotypes, and by the time we got to the hospital, I was really afraid that my wife would behave in the same way when she got to the transition stage, blame me for the pain and push me away. Fortunately, it never happened. The closest we ever came was when my wife was in labor with our second daughter. The only place she could be comfortable was in the shower, and for a while I was in there with her, trying to talk her through the contractions as I massaged her aching back. Then she asked me to leave the bathroom for a while. Sure, that stung for a minute. I felt I should be there with her, but it was clear that she had no intention of hurting me. Unfortunately, not every laboring woman manages to be as graceful under pressure. If your partner happens to say something nasty to you or throws you unceremoniously out of the room for a while, you need to imagine that while she's in labor, her mind is being taken over by an angry rush hour mob, all trying to push and shove their way into an overcrowded subway train. Quite often, the pain she's experiencing is so intense and overwhelming that the only way she can make it through the contractions is to concentrate completely on them. Something as simple and well-meaning as a word or a loving caress can be terribly distracting. So what can you do? Whatever she wants. Fast. If she doesn't want you to touch her, don't insist. Offer to feed her some ice chips instead. If she wants you to get out of the room, go. But tell her you'll be right outside in case she needs you. If the room is pitch black and she tells you it's too bright, agree with her and find something to turn off. If she wants to listen to the 24-hour Elvis station, turn it on. But whatever you do, don't argue with her. Don't try to reason with her, and above all, don't pout if she swears at you or calls you names. She really doesn't mean to, and the last thing she needs to deal with at this moment of crisis is your wounded pride. Stage 2, pushing. Up until the pushing stage, I thought I was completely prepared for dealing with my wife's labor and delivery. I was calm, and despite my occasional feelings of inadequacy, I knew what to expect almost every step of the way. The hospital staff was supportive of my wanting to be with my wife through every contraction. But when the time came to start pushing, they changed. All of a sudden, they were in control. The doctor was called, extra nurses magically appeared, and the room began to fill up with equipment. A scale, a bassinet, a tray of sterilized medical instruments, a wash basin, diapers, towels. We happened to be in a combination labor and birthing room. If in the middle of the pushing stage you find yourself chasing after your wife who's being rushed down the hall to a separate delivery room, don't be alarmed. It may feel like an emergency, but it probably isn't. The nurses told my wife what to do, how to do it, and when. All I could do was watch. And I must admit that at first I felt a little cheated. After all, I was the one who had been there right from the beginning. My baby was about to be born. But when the most important part finally arrived, it looked like I wasn't going to be anything more than a spectator. And unless you're a professional birthing coach or a trained labor and delivery nurse, chances are you're going to feel like a spectator too. Useless and out of control. As I watched the nurses do their stuff, I quickly realized that simply holding your partner's legs and saying, "Push, honey, that's great," isn't always enough. Recognizing a good, productive push, and more importantly, being able to explain how to do one, raise your butt, lower your legs, keep your head back, curl up around your baby like a shrimp, are skills that come from years of experience. But just because you feel like a spectator doesn't mean you actually have to be one. Your partner needs you to be there, to support her, to encourage her, not in another corner of the room or hiding behind a camera, but right there with her. If you back away at this critical time, she may feel abandoned, even though she's surrounded by professionals. So let the medical team take the lead, but hang in there and ask them how you can be involved, although that's a question you should have asked when you first got to the hospital. Stage 2. Birth. Intellectually, I knew my wife was pregnant. I'd been to all the appointments, and I'd heard the heartbeat, seen the ultrasound, and felt the baby kicking. Still, there was something intangible about the whole process. And it wasn't until our baby started crowning, peeking her hairy little head out of my wife's vagina, that all the pieces finally came together. At just about the same moment, I also realized that there was one major advantage to my having been displaced during the pushing stage. I had both hands free to catch the baby as she came out, and believe me, holding my daughter's hot, slimy, bloody little body and snipping the umbilical cord was easily the highlight of the whole occasion. If you think you might want to do this, make sure you've worked out the choreography with your doctor and the nurses before the baby starts crowning. Your partner, unfortunately, is in the worst possible position to see the baby being born. Most hospitals, however, had tried to remedy this situation by making mirrors available. Still, some women are concentrating so hard on the pushing that they may not be interested in looking in the mirror. If you were expecting your newborn to look like the Gerber baby, you may be in for a bit of a shock. Babies are generally born covered with a whitish coating called vernix. They're sometimes blue and frequently covered with blood and mucus. Their eyes may be puffy, their genitals swollen, and their backs and shoulders may be covered with fine hair. In addition, the trip through the birth canal has probably left your baby with a cone-shaped head. All in all, it's the most beautiful sight in the world. Helping her cope. Throughout labor and delivery, your focus should be on your partner. But because childbirth is such a female-intensive thing, a lot of guys don't really understand how important they are to the process. The reality is that you are absolutely indispensable. Yes, there are doctors and nurses and midwives running around all over the place, but your partner is really counting on you most of all to help her get through this. Your being there and being actively involved can make a big, big difference. Women whose partners are supportive during labor and delivery tend to have shorter labors and report experiencing less pain. They also have a more positive attitude toward motherhood. Here are a number of ways you can help your partner cope throughout the labor and delivery. Some of these are drawn from The Best Birth, which I co-wrote with childbirth educator Sarah McMoyler. Remind her to slow her breathing down, just taking in long, deep breaths. Inhale for 5 seconds. Exhale for 5 seconds. It can be very calming. Encourage her to moan during the contractions and rest in between. Screaming isn't very effective in coping with pain, and neither is the patterned breathing taught in many childbirth prep systems. Instead, go for low, growly, guttural sounds, deep and loud. The kinds of sounds you'd make if you tried to lift a car. This is no time to be dainty or to worry about what the people in the next room or on the next floor will think. They're probably making plenty of noises of their own. Help her relax. People coping with pain often clench their jaws, make fists, tense their shoulders, or hold their breath. None of this helps. In fact, it does more harm than good. Get in her face and be direct. This may seem a little aggressive, but it really does work. In early labor, lock eyes with her and tell her what to do. Unclench your jaw. Unfist your hands. Drop your shoulders. Breathe. As labor progresses, skip the words and just show her what you want her to do by letting your body melt, unclenching, and moaning. Doing this is especially important between contractions. Staying tense or tensing up in anticipation of the next uterus-wrenching contraction will make it harder for her to recover during those all-too-brief breaks. Offer sips of water, ice chips, and cold compresses. Offer a massage, back, hands, feet, or whatever she'd like if she wants anything at all. Sometimes when massage is annoying, sustained counterpressure can be just the ticket. Ask her which helps more, high or low on the back, or closer to the tailbone. Verbal anesthesia. Tell her she's doing a great job. It means a lot more coming from you than from a nurse she doesn't know. Simple things like, great job, or stay with it, are remarkably effective. Make sure she hits the bathroom at least once every hour. If she's not peeing that often, she's not drinking enough. Get her up and moving around. Being upright, if at all possible, makes gravity kick in and helps the baby descend. Walking around keeps her body in motion and maximizes the effect that relaxin, a hormone that does just that, can have on the pelvic joints. You may be able to do this during the contractions in early labor, but once she's deep into active labor, do it between the contractions. The placenta. Before our first child was born, it had simply never occurred to me, or to my wife for that matter, that labor and delivery wouldn't end when the baby was born. While you and your partner are admiring your new family member, the placenta, which has been your baby's life support system for the past 5 months or so, still must be delivered. Your partner may continue to have mild contractions for anywhere from 5 minutes to about an hour until this happens. The strange thing about this stage of the delivery is that neither you nor your partner will probably even know it's happening. You'll be much too involved with your new baby. Once the placenta is out, however, you need to decide what to do with it. In this country, most people never even see it, and those who do leave it at the hospital, where it will either be incinerated as medical waste or, more likely, used for biomedical research or sold to a cosmetics company. There are actually a surprising number of placenta-based beauty products. But in many other cultures, the placenta is considered to have a permanent, almost magical bond with the child it nourished in the womb, and disposal is handled with a great deal more reverence. In fact, most cultures that have placenta rituals believe that if it's not properly buried, the child or the parents or even the entire village will suffer some terrible consequences. In rural Peru, for example, immediately after the birth of a child, the father is required to go to a far-off location and bury the placenta deep enough so that no animals or people will accidentally discover it. Otherwise, the placenta may become jealous of the attention paid to the baby and may take revenge by causing an epidemic. In some South American Indian cultures, people believe that a child's life can be influenced by objects that are buried with its placenta. According to anthropologist J.R. Davidson, parents of the Koya tribe bury miniature implements copied after the ones used in adult life with the placenta in the hopes of assuring that the infant will be a good worker. Boys' placentas are frequently buried with a shovel or a pick, and girls are buried with a loom or a hoe. In the Philippines, some mothers bury the placenta with books as a way of ensuring intelligence. But placentas are not always buried. In ancient Egypt, pharaoh's placentas were wrapped in special containers to keep them from harm. Sometimes a placenta would be used as a stand-in for the pharaoh at public events, according to researcher Anne Glauser. Some historians believe that the smallest pyramids were actually built as tombs for pharaoh's placentas. And a wealthy Inca in Ecuador built a solid gold statue of his mother, complete with his placenta in her womb. Even today, The people of many cultures believe that placentas have special powers. A lot of women, including a growing number of Hollywood celebrities, believe that placentophagy, which is ingesting cooked or dried placenta, can reduce or eliminate postpartum depression or help keep their skin looking youthful. In parts of Peru, placentas are burned. The ashes are mixed with water, and the mixture is then fed to the babies as a remedy for a variety of childhood illnesses. Traditional Vietnamese medicine uses placentas to combat sterility and senility, and in India, touching a placenta is supposed to help a childless woman conceive a healthy baby of her own. In China, some believe that breastfeeding mothers can improve the quality of their milk by drinking a broth made of boiled placenta or speed up labor by eating a piece of it dried. This sort of placenta usage isn't limited to non-Western cultures. In medieval Europe, if a child was born with a caul, that's with the amniotic membranes over his head, the placenta would be saved, dried, and fed to the child on his 10th birthday. If it wasn't done, it was believed that the child might become a vampire after death. Whatever you and your partner decide to do, it's probably best to keep it a secret, at least from the hospital staff. Some states try to regulate what you can do with a placenta and may even prohibit you from taking it home. Although, if you really want to, you can probably find a sympathetic nurse who will pack it up for you. We deliberately left our first daughter's placenta at the hospital, but we stored the second one in our freezer for a year before burying it, along with the placentas of some of our friends' children, and planting an apple tree above them. 12 years later, at her bat mitzvah, we ate some of the apples from that tree, and yes, they tasted perfectly fine. Dealing with contingencies. Unfortunately, not all labors and deliveries proceed exactly as planned. In fact, most don't. As we'll discuss in the next chapter, nearly a third of babies in the U.S. are born by cesarean section, and 60 to 80% of mothers who deliver vaginally are medicated in some way, usually with an epidural. We'll talk about that in detail in just a minute. As with so many other aspects of your pregnancy experience, having good, clear information about what's really going on and what the options are during labor and delivery will help you make informed, intelligent decisions about how to handle the unexpected or the unplanned. The key to getting the information you need is to ask questions and to keep on asking until you're completely satisfied. Find out about the risks, the benefits, and the effects on your partner as well as on the baby. The only exception to this rule is when there's a clear medical emergency. In that case, save your questions for later. Here are a few of the contingencies that can come up during the birth and how they might affect you, your partner, and the baby. Pain. If you've taken a traditional Lamaze or Bradley childbirth class or read many pregnancy books, and even if you haven't, you and your partner may be planning to have a natural, meaning medication-free, childbirth. Unfortunately, natural childbirth often sounds better and less painful than it actually turns out to be. According to Marcy Lobel, director of the Stony Brook Pregnancy Project at Stony Brook University, popular books written for pregnant women often understate the degree of pain experienced during birth and may overstate the effectiveness of childbirth preparation in reducing pain. And think about all those childbirth images you've seen in movies and on TV. The pain looks unbearable, but it never lasts any more than a few minutes. Because your partner is the one who's experiencing the physical pain, defer to her judgment when considering ways to manage it. This doesn't mean, however, that you don't have anything to say about the issue. As labor progresses, your partner will become less rational and less able to make big decisions, so it's up to you to be her advocate, to make sure she has the kind of birth she wants, or at least as close to it as you can get. That's why I strongly suggest the two of you have some thorough discussions about her attitude toward medication before she goes into labor, so you know whether she'd want you to suggest it when you get concerned or wait until she requests it. You might also want to come up with a code word that means, "I really want drugs now." Some women may scream for the doctor or you to do something about the pain, but not really want drugs. If you do end up having a discussion about medication sometime during labor, make sure you do it in the most supportive possible way. It's painful to have to watch the one you love suffer, but starting an argument when she's in the middle of a contraction isn't a smart idea, and you're not going to resolve anything anyway. Despite the fact that most women get some kind of chemical pain relief, many feel that taking medication is a sign of weakness or that they've failed as women and as mothers. It's as if having an unmedicated childbirth is part of the transition to womanhood. In addition, some childbirth preparation methods view medication as the first step along a path that ultimately leads to birth complications and/or cesarean section. Neither of these scenarios is, by any stretch of the imagination, the rule. If you check into the hospital with a pregnant partner and leave a few days later with a no longer pregnant partner and a healthy baby, you win. It shouldn't matter how at all it happened, as long as the medication or the procedure was medically necessary, and it almost always is. I'm not suggesting that your partner should use or that she'll even need pain medication, but whatever you do, knowing a little about your options is always a good idea. Let's take a minute to talk about exactly what those options are. There is a big difference between coping and suffering. Despite all the emphasis on natural childbirth these days, more and more women seem to be opting for some kind of chemical pain relief during labor and childbirth. Actually, there's evidence that women have been searching for alternatives to natural birth ever since they were first introduced in the 1840s, says obstetric anesthesiologist Donald Caton, author of What a Blessing She Had Chloroform, The Medical and Social Response to the Pain of Childbirth from 1800 to the Present. Women today have literally dozens of options that fall into two basic categories, regionals and systemics. Regionals are medications that work only on specific regions of the body, hence the name. The most common of all regionals, and of all childbirth-related pain medication for that matter, is the epidural, which is usually administered during active labor, the second phase of the first stage, when the pain is the greatest. Your partner will have to lean over or curl up on her side while an anesthesiologist numbs her lower back, inserts a medication-carrying catheter into the epidural space that surrounds the spinal cord, and tapes it to her back. According to the American Pregnancy Association, the goal of an epidural is to provide analgesia, or pain relief, rather than anesthesia, which leads to a total lack of feeling. Epidurals are widely considered the safest and most effective labor painkiller available. They kick in within a few minutes and will block the pain of your partner's contractions while still leaving her awake and alert. Perhaps most importantly, they don't cross the placenta and affect the baby. Until just a few years ago, epidurals carried the risk of decreasing maternal blood pressure or reducing the woman's ability to feel when to push, which could slow down the course of labor, as well as causing headaches and nausea. And a lot of people thought that epidurals increased the risk of a cesarean or instrument birth. But today, anesthesiologists are better able to fine-tune the dose, greatly reducing those risks. A growing body of research shows that women who have epidurals aren't any more likely to have a C-section or instrument birth. In fact, epidurals may actually move labor along more quickly. By blocking the pain, the woman can get a well-deserved break, sometimes even a nap. So when it's time to push, she'll be refreshed and strong. Another problem with epidurals used to be that since they numb the lower body, women were confined to their beds for the duration. But the combined spinal epidural or walking epidural offers the same pain relief and offers at least some mobility, although despite the name, your partner probably won't be able to walk. Walking epidurals aren't available everywhere, so ask your partner's practitioner whether it's available at your hospital. Epidurals aren't perfect. For about 10% of women, the epidural doesn't completely block the pain, and sometimes it can affect one side of the body more than the other. And there may be side effects, but they're rare. These include shivering, nausea, itching, and a drop in blood pressure. You might also check with the hospital to see whether PCEA, which is patient-controlled epidural anesthesia, is a possibility. The way it works is that the anesthesiologist gets the epidural up and running, and then allows the patient to adjust the amount of medication she gets, within reason. As with any kind of patient-controlled medication, patients don't use nearly as much as a doctor would have given them. Seems that just knowing relief is a button push away decreases the need. Other less common regional options include the pudendal block, which is an injection given into each side of the vagina that deadens the vaginal opening, and the spinal block, an injection into the fluid around the spinal cord in the lower back, It's similar to an epidural, but doesn't last as long and carries a slightly greater risk of complications. The other option is systemics, which are a category of whole-body pain relief that includes sedatives, tranquilizers, and narcotics such as Demerol and fentanyl, which are usually given as injections or added to existing IV lines. It also includes general anesthesia, which knocks the recipient out completely and is rarely used except when performing an emergency cesarean. Besides taking the edge off the contractions almost immediately, one of the major advantages to systemic medications is that your partner can use them from the very beginning of labor. They may relieve a lot of her anxiety and won't usually have much of an impact on her ability to push or to sense her contractions. On the downside, though, these medications affect your partner's entire body and can cause a wide variety of side effects, including drowsiness, dizziness, and nausea. In some ways, these drugs do less to remove the pain than to make your partner simply stop caring about it. Even worse, since they go right into your partner's bloodstream, they also cross the placenta, meaning that at birth, the baby could be drowsy, unable to suck properly for a short while, or, in rare cases, unable to breathe without assistance. Fortunately, those symptoms go away pretty quickly on their own. There's also a drug, Narcan, that can reverse these side effects. Interestingly, your partner's use or non-use of pain medication may have an impact on you as well. For most expectant dads, anything that makes our partners more comfortable and hurt less is great. But besides that, medication can also reduce the stress and make the whole experience more pleasant for us. In a study of how a laboring woman's use of epidurals affects her partner, Italian researchers Giorgio Campogna and Michaela Camorsia found that fathers whose partners did not receive epidural analgesia felt their presence as troublesome and unnecessary. On the other hand, when the mom did have an epidural, fathers felt three times more helpful and involved and were less anxious and stressed than dads whose partners went med-free. For some guys, though, reducing her pain may be a source of disappointment in a twisted yet understandable sort of way. We're supposed to be there to help her through the pain, the thinking goes, but if she doesn't need us to do that, maybe she doesn't need us at all. In other words, reducing the pain may also reduce the father's sense of usefulness and importance. A word of advice. If your partner wants some pain medication, support her. There are plenty of other ways to be helpful. There are quite a few other reasons your partner might need some chemical intervention, starting with exhaustion. In some cases, labor is progressing so slowly or has been stalled for so long that your partner's practitioner may become concerned that she'll be too exhausted by the time she needs to push. This was exactly what happened during the birth of my middle daughter. After 20 hours of labor and only 4 centimeters of dilation, our doctor suggested Pitocin, a drug that stimulates contractions, together with an epidural. This chemical cocktail removed the pain of labor while allowing my wife's cervix to dilate fully and quickly. I'm convinced that this approach actually prevented a C-section by giving my wife a well-deserved breather before she started pushing. Induced labor. Anytime after 40 weeks of pregnancy, your baby is officially fully baked. They don't always get this piece of news, though, and are sometimes reluctant to come out. There are all sorts of supposedly surefire ways to bring on labor, and you'll start hearing every one of them as soon as you mention that the baby is late. Eat certain kinds of salad dressings or vinegars. Eat spicy foods. Go on long walks. Drink cod liver oil and more. There's actually some research suggesting that sex may help. Nipple stimulation and your partner's orgasm may trigger some contractions. Plus, semen has prostaglandin in it, which is similar to the gel or pill that's used to induce labor. And as Lissa Rankin puts it, messing around with the cervix can trigger contractions and get things started. But before you try any kind of home remedy, check with your practitioner to make sure it's safe. If your partner's due date is long past, your practitioner may decide that things have gone on long enough. This will happen about 2 months after your partner has reached the same conclusion. And he'll suggest jump-starting the labor with Pitocin or Cytotec, a type of prostaglandin. Some people claim that Pitocin results in more painful labors and increases the C-section rate, but just as many disagree, saying that all it does is produce normal labor. Hey, not so fast there, little lady. If your partner's or your baby's health is genuinely at risk, her doctor may want to induce labor before the 39th or 40th week. It seems that an increasing number of women are trying to give birth early, and they give all sorts of non-medical reasons. Some are afraid of giving birth to a baby who's too big. Some want to make sure they deliver on a day their doc will be on call, or maybe before she goes on vacation. Some want to have their baby born on a specific day, like a relative's or friend's birthday, a particularly auspicious day, or the last day of the year to get the tax deduction. And others want to make sure a particular person can be there for the birth, say a close friend, a relative, or People magazine paparazzi. And some are just sick and tired of being pregnant. Hopefully, your partner's provider won't go along with any non-medical preterm induction requests. But if she does, try to talk her and your partner out of it. New research from the National Child and Maternal Health Education Program has found that even a few weeks can make a big difference. That organization considers full term to be 39 to 40 weeks. Babies born earlier, they say, are at risk for problems with breathing, feeding, and controlling their temperature. They're also more likely to be admitted to the neonatal intensive care unit and develop infections. Catherine Spong, deputy director of the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, adds, "The baby's brain almost doubles in size in the last several weeks of pregnancy, and the brain is forming all the connections that are going to be important for coordination, movement, and for learning." Enough said? There are quite a few other common birth contingencies. Let's stop with forceps or vacuum. If your partner's cervix is completely dilated and she's been pushing for a while but the baby refuses to budge, her practitioner may suggest using forceps, long tongs with scoops on the end. Kind of imagine salad tongs that are big enough to pick up a coconut, to help things along. It used to be that the very word forceps struck fear into every expectant parent's heart, but today they're used only to gently grasp the baby's head to guide it through the birth canal. Some forceps deliveries will leave the baby with bruises in the temple or jawline area for a few days or a week. In very rare instances, permanent scarring or other damage can occur. In addition, your partner will need additional medication and may require a larger than normal episiotomy. In an increasing number of cases, instead of forceps, doctors are using a vacuum-type suction device that attaches to the top of the baby's head to move the baby around the same way. Vacuum extractors may leave some swelling or bruising on your baby's scalp, but your partner won't need as much pain medication as she would have with forceps. The doctor may also suggest using forceps or vacuum if the baby is in distress and a vaginal birth needs to be sped up, or if your partner is too exhausted or drugged to push effectively. Keep in mind that most OBGYNs are trained in either forceps, that's usually the older docs, or vacuum extraction, the younger docs, not both. Used appropriately, one and or the other can sometimes prevent the need for a C-section. Episiotomy. As I mentioned earlier, an episiotomy involves making a small cut in the perineum, the area between the vagina and the anus, to enlarge the vaginal opening and allow for easier passage of the baby's head. Did you just wince? I sure as hell did. Only a decade or so ago, the episiotomy rate for first-time mothers under an obstetrician's care was 70 to 90%. The thought was that a controlled cut would help women avoid bowel, urinary, and sexual problems after delivery. But recent research has shown that episiotomy may actually increase the risk of those problems. Today, the episiotomy rate is under 20%. Overall, about 70% of first-time moms will have a small, spontaneous tear. The phrase spontaneous tear sounds absolutely frightening to me, but it turns out that with an episiotomy, the flesh can tear even more. So as contradictory as it might seem, those natural tears are often preferable and less painful than a routine episiotomy. But the procedure may be legitimately indicated if the baby is extremely large and squeezing through the vagina might harm the baby, if forceps are used, if the practitioner can see that numerous tears are going to happen, and if the baby is breech, meaning that the head is up and the butt or feet are pointing down. Only 3 to 4% of single babies are born this way, but about a third of all twins are. Actually, there are several different types of breech births. Frank breech means that the baby's feet are straight up next to his head and the baby will come out butt first. Complete breech means that the butt is down and the baby is sitting cross-legged. Footling breech means that one or both feet are pointing down. There's little you can do to prevent your baby from getting into any position he or she wants to, but most doctors in the United States will not deliver breech babies vaginally. This means that if the baby can't be turned, usually through a non-surgical process called an external version, it's going to be delivered by C-section. Electronic fetal monitors, or EFMs. EFMs have been around since the early 1970s, and today they're used in 85% of births. They come in two flavors, external and internal. The external variety is a rather complicated-looking machine, complete with graphs, digital outputs, and high-tech beeping. Two belts are connected to the machine and get strapped to your partner's abdomen. One monitors the baby's heartbeat. The other monitors your partner's contractions. Fetal monitors are really pretty cool. Properly hooked up, they are so accurate that by watching the digital display, you'll be able to tell when your partner's contractions are starting, even before she feels them. And if she has an IUPC, which is an intrauterine pressure catheter, a tube that lies next to the baby and measures contraction strength, you'll actually be able to tell how intense they'll be. In one fascinating study, researchers Christy Williams and Deborah Umberson found that most expectant fathers like fetal monitors, partly because by getting information, we feel like we're really involved. By observing and communicating the changing intensity of the contractions, these men believed that they were able to provide valuable information to their wives, they wrote. This creates a role for husbands to play in labor and delivery that is, from their perspective, more important than merely providing support and encouragement. Note the use of the phrases, these men believed, and from their perspective. Williams and Umberson also found that women often perceived the monitors as a nuisance and the information they provided not particularly helpful. After all, they're getting the same information anyway, but in a slightly different way. It hurts like hell. And the monitors don't always reflect reality. The contraction may look like it's over on the screen, but it can be far from over for her. So be careful. These monitors may help you guide your partner through the contraction, but think long and hard before saying something like, "Ready, honey? Here it comes. Looks like a big one." Unfortunately, I know whereof I speak. In many hospitals, laboring women are routinely hooked up to external fetal monitors as soon as they check in, despite the fact that the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists doesn't recommend it for low-risk pregnancies. If your partner doesn't have an epidural and is still walking, she may be able to get intermittent monitoring, which is done with a stethoscope or a handheld Doppler like the one you heard your baby's heartbeat through in the doctor's office all those months ago. Another option is portable monitoring. She'll still have the belt strapped on, but they'll be wirelessly broadcasting heartbeat and contraction data to the medical team. If, however, she has an epidural or is on Pitocin, continuous monitoring is usually non-negotiable. Ditto when it comes time to push. Internal fetal monitors come in two varieties, an electrode attached to the baby's scalp and the IUPC method mentioned above. If your practitioner feels that it's important to keep closer tabs on the baby's heart rate, your partner will get one or both of those internal monitors. Unless there's some compelling reason why your partner needs continuous monitoring, say if there were signs of fetal distress, for example, you and she will be a lot better off with as little of it as possible. Here's why. There's too much room for misinterpreting the results. One study had four doctors interpret 50 different tracings. Those are the printouts that are generated by the monitor. The four concurred only 22% of the time. Worse yet, 2 months later, when the same doctors were asked to evaluate the same tracings, they interpreted more than 20% of them differently. It can scare the hell out of you. When my wife was hooked up to a fetal monitor during her first labor, we were comforted by the sound of the baby's steady 140 beat per minute heartbeat. But at one point, the heart rate dropped to 120, then 100, then 80, then 60. Nothing was wrong. The doctor was just trying to change the baby's position, but hearing her little heart slow down that much nearly gave my wife and me heart attacks. If your partner's practitioner believes that monitoring is medically necessary, turn the volume down. Better yet, all the way off. It's not clear that it works. Fetal monitoring was originally implemented in the hope that it would prevent cerebral palsy. But despite the very best of intentions, it has led to an increase in C-sections and instrument deliveries. And, ironically, it didn't do anything for cerebral palsy either. The rate has stayed the same for the past 50 years. The moral of the story is that continuous monitoring can sometimes generate too much information. The doctor might see something happen to the baby on the monitor, get worried, and operate. In a lot of cases, what looks like fetal distress on the tracing ends up going away on its own. After the birth, hey, baby! One of the first contacts you'll have with your baby is cutting his or her umbilical cord. With a vaginal birth, you'll actually be disconnecting your baby from mom. With a C-section, the surgeons will do the disconnecting and you'll do a ceremonial snip. Either way, there's something amazing about the way it makes you feel connected with your baby. Ironic, isn't it? Researchers Sonia Brandau and Barbara Figueiredo found that fathers who cut their baby's cord were more emotionally involved with the baby a month after the birth than those dads who didn't make the cut. Your baby's first few minutes outside the womb are a time of intense physical and emotional release for you and your partner. At long last, you get to meet the unique little person you created together. Your partner may want to try nursing the baby, although most newborns aren't really hungry for the first 12 hours or so. And you'll probably want to stroke his or her brand new skin and marvel at those tiny fingernails. But depending on the hospital, the conditions of the birth, and whether or not you've been perfectly clear about your preferences, your baby's first few minutes could be spent being poked and prodded by doctors and nurses instead of being held and cuddled by you. 1 minute after birth, your baby will be given an Apgar test to allow the medical staff a quick take on your baby's overall condition. Created in 1953 by Dr. Virginia Apgar, the test measures your baby's appearance, skin color, pulse, grimace, that's the reflexes, activity, and respiration. A nurse or midwife will score each category on a scale of 0 to 2. A bluish or pale baby might get a 0 for color, while a very pink one would get a 2. A baby who's breathing irregularly or shallowly might get a 0 for respiration, while one who's breathing well or crying loudly would get a 2. Most babies score in the 7 to 9 range. Just on principle, almost no one gets a 10 unless it's the child of someone the medical team knows. The test will be repeated at 5 minutes after birth. Shortly after the birth, your baby will need to be weighed, measured, given an ID bracelet, bathed, fingerprinted, diapered, and wrapped in a blanket. Some hospitals also photograph each newborn. After that, most hospitals, frequently as required by law, apply silver nitrate drops or an antibiotic ointment to your baby's eyes as a protection against gonorrhea. Although these procedures should be done within an hour of birth, ask the staff if they can hold off for a few minutes while you and your partner get acquainted with your baby. If, however, your baby was delivered by C-section or if there were any other complications, the baby will be rushed off to have his or her little lungs suctioned before returning for the rest of the cleanup routine. Seeing the baby. Some hospitals have very rigid rules regarding parent-infant contact. Feeding may be highly regulated and the hours you can visit your child may be limited. Other hospitals are more flexible. The hospitals where all three of my children were born no longer have a nursery, except to care for babies with serious health problems. Healthy babies are expected to stay in the mother's room for their entire hospital stay, and many hospitals allow the new father to spend the night with mom and baby. Check with the staff of your hospital to find out their policy. So far, we've been talking about births that go, more or less, according to plan. But when that doesn't happen, the chances of having a cesarean section increase dramatically. And that's why we're devoting the entire next chapter to that exact topic. Cesarean section. All things being equal, most parents would prefer to bring their babies into the world normally. And most of the time, that's what happens. But childbirth is one of those uncontrollable, unpredictable events, and things don't always go exactly the way they're supposed to. In the United States, in fact, more than 30% of all children born in hospitals are delivered by C-section. What's going on with your partner? Most childbirth preparation classes put a great deal of emphasis on natural, unmedicated deliveries. As we discussed earlier, many women, therefore, feel a tremendous amount of pressure to deliver vaginally and may actually consider themselves failures if they don't, especially after they've invested hours and hours in a painful labor. In addition, recovering from a cesarean is much different from recovering from a vaginal birth. My wife and I spent 3 nights in the hospital after the C-section delivery of our first daughter. But after our second daughter was born, vaginally, we stayed in the hospital for only 5 hours. Okay, we rushed it a little. Most people stay 24 to 48 hours after a regular birth, but my wife really wanted to leave. What's going on with you? Your take on the C-section is undoubtedly going to be quite different from your partner's. Researcher Catherine May found that only 8% of men whose partners delivered by C-section objected to the operation. 92% were greatly relieved. Although I didn't participate in that study, it accurately reflects my own experience. It simply had never occurred to me that my wife might somehow have failed. On the contrary, I remember feeling incredibly thankful that her suffering would finally end. And seeing how quickly and painlessly the baby was delivered made me wonder why we hadn't done it sooner. Despite the relief a father may feel on his partner's behalf, a C-section can be a trying experience for him. As a rule, he's separated from his wife while she's being prepped for surgery and usually isn't given any information about what's happening. I remember being left in the hall outside the operating room, trying to keep an eye on my wife through a tiny window. Besides being terribly scared, I felt completely helpless and useless as the doctors, nurses, and assistants scurried around, blocking my view, getting dressed, washing, opening packages of scalpels, tubes, and who knows what else. Only one person, the pediatrician who ended up attending the delivery, took a minute to pat me on the shoulder, call me by name, and tell me that everything would be all right. I've never felt more grateful to another person in my life. When they finally let me into the operating room, wearing a mask and a fashionable set of scrubs that I actually still have, I was told, no discussion allowed, to sit by my wife's head. There was a curtain across her chest that prevented me from seeing what the surgeons were doing. I was ready to put on some gloves and help out with the operation, but whenever I stood up to get a better view, the anesthesiologist shoved me back down into my seat. I was too exhausted to argue. But a friend of mine, whose partner had a C-section in the same hospital a few years later, did argue and was able to go around to the business end of the operation. I've heard from several OBs that part of the reason they try to keep dads up by the mom's head is that if there's ever a time when dads pass out, this is it. And the anesthesiologists simply don't want to have to deal with two patients at the same time. As OB Lisa Rankin puts it, it's not personal. I'm happy to have dads at the business end, but they sometimes end up on the floor. Staying involved. My friend and I may be among the lucky ones. In some hospitals, men aren't allowed into the operating room at all. Others permit them only if they've taken a special C-section class, which most people wouldn't do unless they were planning for one. Hopefully, even before you check in, you and your partner will have already told your OB exactly what your preferences are should there be a C-section, and you'll be familiar with any relevant hospital policies. Don't forget that although a C-section is a fairly commonplace operation, American doctors do about 1.5 million of them every year, it's still major surgery, and after the operation, your partner will need some extra special care. First of all, as strange as it may sound, after having a C-section, your partner may feel terribly left out. She will probably have been fully awake during the operation and will be anxious to meet the new baby. But whereas after a vaginal birth, the mother gets to see and touch the baby immediately, after a C-section, the baby is usually quickly whisked away to have his or her lungs suctioned out. Sometimes the suctioning may happen even before the baby has been fully delivered. Babies born vaginally have most of the amniotic fluid and other gunk in their lungs squeezed out on the way through the birth canal, but with C-section babies, it often has to be removed manually. You may get to make a ceremonial umbilical cord cut. The surgeons will have already cut the cord during the delivery. If the baby is being cared for right in the delivery room, make sure to tell your partner exactly what's happening. She'll want to know. Although, depending on what the anesthesiologist used, she may be too drugged up to care very much, so take plenty of pictures. In some hospitals, C-section babies are removed from the delivery room immediately after the birth and taken straight to the nursery where they're washed, examined, and put through basically the same procedures as vaginal birth babies. This whole process can take anywhere from a few minutes to a few hours. Although you might want to remain with your partner and comfort her immediately after the delivery, ask the doctor whether you can stay with your baby instead. It's bad enough for a newborn to be deprived of snuggling with one of his parents right away, but it would be worse if the baby couldn't be with either of you. Staying with our daughter also eased my paranoia that she might be switched in the nursery, a highly unlikely occurrence given the rather elaborate security measures in place in most hospitals these days. But don't get too upset if the doctor says no. A lot of C-section babies are not medically stable at birth. Not in danger, they just require a little extra attention. And the staff won't want you hovering around getting in the way. When you finally do get to the nursery, start getting undressed. No, not completely, just take off your shirt. Some skin-to-skin contact with your baby can have wonderful effects. After births with complications, mothers are often not available to their babies for contact, writes Swedish researcher Kirsten Erlandson. Babies who do not have that contact take longer to settle and may lag in learning to breastfeed. According to Erlandson, the dad's skin-to-skin contact with his baby after a C-section is just as comforting and calming as the mother's, and it's a lot better than leaving the baby alone in a bassinet in the nursery. C-section babies stop crying within 15 minutes of being put on dad's chest, and they become drowsy within an hour after birth, compared to 110 minutes for those in bassinets without dad. Common medical reasons for a cesarean section. Although some C-sections are planned, most happen when a vaginal birth could be dangerous to the mom, baby, or both. Here are some of those reasons. The mother's pelvis is too small to allow the baby's head to pass through the birth canal, although there's really no way to tell whether this is true until she actually tries to deliver vaginally. Failure of the labor to progress. After hours of labor, the woman may be too exhausted to push the baby out, or her cervix stops opening after active labor has begun. The baby is distressed in some way. Her heartbeat has dropped too far. The heartbeat pattern is worrisome, or there are other problems. You're about to have more than one baby. Your partner has a medical condition that puts her at risk, including a heart condition, diabetes, high blood pressure, an active case of genital herpes, or obesity. Placenta problems. Abrupto placenta, which you may remember is the separation of the placenta from the uterine wall before labor begins, causes bleeding and can threaten the lives of both mother and baby. Placenta previa, where the placenta is fully or partially blocking the opening of the cervix, causes hemorrhaging and prevents the baby from leaving the uterus. The position of the baby. Under certain circumstances, if the baby is breech, coming out butt or feet first, as you remember, or transverse, laying sideways instead of head down, a C-section is far more likely. Previous C-section births. Until the 1980s, the prevailing wisdom was once a C-section, always a C-section. Then, in response to an increasing C-section rate, many OBGYNs proposed VBAC, vaginal birth after cesarean, as a way of reducing that rate. The VBAC rate increased steadily until the 1990s. But as more women opted for VBAC, the number of cases of uterine rupture increased. Percentage-wise, though, the risk was still pretty low. Still, just to be safe, many OBs started recommending against VBAC, and some hospitals have banned them entirely. But recent research has found that many women who have had a C-section are good candidates for VBAC. Typically, that means she's under 35, hasn't had any pregnancy complications, isn't overdue, and isn't carrying an especially big baby. About 75% of women who attempt a VBAC are successful. If your partner has had a C-section with a previous birth, ask her practitioner to explain the risks and benefits of VBAC versus a scheduled repeat C-section and make the decision that's best for your growing family. Your doctor may think the baby's too big. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists define too big as anything over 4,500 grams, which is about 9 pounds 4 ounces. With babies this size, there's an increased chance of shoulder dystocia, where the head delivers but the shoulders get stuck. If mom is a diabetic, the definition of too big goes down to 4,000 grams, roughly 8.5 pounds. Your partner's age. The older she is, the greater her chance of needing a C-section. Lori Green, a San Francisco OBGYN who delivered my youngest, puts it this way. The uterus is a muscle, and like any other muscle, its strength decreases with age. A woman whose uterus struggles to force a baby out when she's 42 might very well have been able to deliver the same size baby with no problem when she was 22. Suspected abnormality of the baby. If the baby is expected to have a birth defect or other abnormality that might make vaginal delivery risky, the doctor might recommend a C-section, not just to minimize birth trauma, but to make sure all the right specialists can be on hand to give your baby the best shot at thriving. Some of the most common non-medical reasons for a C-section. As cynical as it sounds, sometimes C-sections aren't really necessary. Here's why some of them happen. It's easier. Some OBs consider C-sections safer than vaginal deliveries. Demographics. Although the national C-section rate is nearly 33%, the actual number varies widely. In some states, Florida, New Jersey, and Louisiana, the rate is close to 40%. In others, New Mexico, Utah, Alaska, it's under 25%. Married women and those with insurance are more likely to have a cesarean than women without, 34% versus 25%. And women over 40 are about twice as likely as women under 25, 50% versus 25%. High C-section rates aren't limited to the United States. In Thailand and Vietnam, for example, the rate is over 35%. In Paraguay and Ecuador, it's over 40%. In China, it's close to 50%, and in Brazil, where it's considered low class to give birth vaginally, it's 70%, actually 80 to 90% or more in private hospitals. Your partner may just want one. Picking the exact delivery date may enable a woman to have the baby at a time that's particularly convenient for her or her family. Then there's the too posh to push idea that's been driven by Hollywood. Quite a few celebrity moms have opted for a C-section because they're worried about the pain of a vaginal delivery or the impact that a natural birth could have on their sexual or urinary function. Cesarean section prior to advanced labor is virtually 100% effective in eliminating those problems, writes OB and researcher Brent Bost. Dr. Bost has also found that healthy women who undergo elective cesarean section experience a relatively low rate of short-term complications. And long-term complications are rare. On the other hand, Sarah McMoyler says, consider the trade-off, several hours of pain, most of which can be eliminated with an epidural, versus 6 weeks of not being able to go up and down the stairs, hold your baby without hurting, or drive. I guess if you have a chauffeur and servants, that's really not much of an issue. Culture. In Chinese, Hindu, and other cultures, the calendar is filled with auspicious and non-auspicious days, and some people feel that the right birthday can make a huge difference in a child's life. Fear of lawsuits. If something goes wrong with the birth, fetal or maternal distress, or even a birth defect that a lawyer might attribute to something that happened during the delivery, the obstetrician is likely to be blamed for having let the labor go on too long. In some cases, but by no means all, OBs perform a C-section to minimize risk and speed things up. Finances. The vast majority of medical professionals perform C-sections only when they're medically necessary. But sometimes money creeps into the equation, usually subconsciously. Researchers Marit Rahavi from the University of British Columbia and Aaron Johnson of MIT found that in hospitals where there are financial incentives to perform C-sections, usually higher insurance reimbursements to both the doctor and the hospital, the C-section rates are higher. Clearly, some of those C-sections aren't truly necessary. Mothers who are physicians, and who would presumably be less likely to go along with an unnecessary procedure, are 7-9% less likely to have an emergency C-section than other highly educated patients. Convenience. Your partner may want a guarantee that a specific doctor will be available to do the delivery.